We have six cases on our calendar this morning. Two district court patent cases, two veterans cases from the Court of Appeals for veterans claims, and two government employee cases from the Merit Systems Protection Board. And both of the latter will be submitted on the briefs and therefore not be argued. Our first case is Touchcom versus Bereskin and Parr et al., 2008-12-29, Mr. Corpus.
Thank you. The narrow question for the court this morning in this case is whether it can assert personal jurisdiction for a malpractice claim over a foreign patent agent who filed for U.S. patent in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office through the Patent Cooperation Treaty procedure. Now, the appellee's arguments boils down to the proposition that a foreign attorney can hold himself and his firm out to be registered to secure U.S. patents, solicit services from a client to obtain a U.S. patent, but because the foreign patent agent chose to file not directly but through the treaty and the WIPO, they can be insulated for liability for any malpractice. We submit that the court should not create such a loophole and that argument is inconsistent.
Well, they're not insulated from liability from any malpractice. The question is whether or not the case, at least it seems from the record we have, could be brought in Canada.
Well,
So it's not true that they're insulated from any liability. It's just whether a question of whether or not the U.S. courts, and this court in Virginia in particular, have...
That is correct. Insulated from U.S. liability. That's correct. The facts are not in dispute, and they are, as I mentioned. The argument we submit is a technicality. There is no doubt that there would be jurisdiction over both the foreign patent agent and the firm if they filed the patent application directly in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
Why is there no doubt about that?
Because we believe that has already been decided by the District Court of Appeals in the Lextex decision, where they said, in plain terms, there can be no serious question but that defendants' appellees were transacting business within the district within the usual meaning of that concept. Well, one can hardly demand the right to come to the
district. With all due respect to the D.C. Circuit, we're not bound by that.
You are not bound by that, but the reasoning of the decision, and the court did use very strong terms, if I can just complete the quote, one can hardly demand the right to come to the District of Columbia to pursue activities exclusively on behalf of an out-of-state principal and expect to be absolutely immune from suit here by that principal for causes of action arising directly out of the performance of such activities.
Of course, the court there was dealing with D.C. law, correct? And now we're dealing with Virginia law.
Yes, but I don't think there's any real difference in the provisions. The court was dealing with the government exception, the government context exception, but in order to get to the exception, you first have to cross the hurdle of is the jurisdiction in the first place.
Here the attorneys were never in Virginia. We're not dealing with a Virginia applicant. The application, whether it went through WIPO, PTC, or mailed directly to the USPTO, was all by the mail.
There was
no action in Virginia except a filing in a federal office by mail.
But that filing is the most significant act to be taken in connection with the retainer. The attorneys were retained to secure a U.S. patent, and the most significant act is the filing of the patent. We submit that by filing for a U.S. patent application, whether it be by mail, and in today's environment, filing by mail, filing electronically is much more prevalent, and the court has recognized that in the Burger King case. Whether it's submitted by mail, whether it's submitted in person, we submit that is the key act that exposed them to jurisdiction. They purposely avail themselves to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, knowing it's in Virginia. They're not really arguing that they didn't know in Virginia, they couldn't. And they should expect that there would be jurisdiction over their actions.
What was the error committed in Virginia? What was the error committed in Virginia?
The error committed in Virginia is twofold. Number one is the patent was filed in Virginia through the agency of the WIPO, but it ended up being filed, the patent application was filed in Virginia with the error in it, with the missing source code. It wasn't picked up by the attorneys at the time of filing. Then there
but
was
they couldn't make the change in the interim, right? I mean, they were stuck with what they had sent over by the WIPO.
The only thing they could have done is withdraw the application and refile.
Right, but they could not make the change in the interim before it reached the U.S. Patent Office or as it reached the U.S. Patent Office.
That's right. They could have, however, withdrawn the application and refiled the new one.
But then you might have problems with other art that was filed in the interim because you filed through the WPO because of the attempts at least to get the earlier filing dates.
Well, we wouldn't be any worse off than we are today.
Well, there are requirements that have to be followed. Now, my concern is twofold. First of all, the error that's committed is committed in a practice before the Patent Office. So does it really arise under the patent laws under 1338? Because there's no jurisdiction here otherwise, is it?
Well, the district court did find that it does arise for the purpose of the motion to remand. So it would be inconsistent for us to now have the same argument used against Touchcom for no finding of personal jurisdiction. We submit that once the district court found that it does arise under the patent laws for the purpose of the remand motion, the same can be applied to the person and should be applied to the personal jurisdiction issue. Your Honor, I wanted to address the question you asked me earlier. The other error that took place in Virginia is that there was subsequent correspondence with the Patent Office and no attempt to correct or withdraw the application even after the initial filing. That's the second act that we
see. But let me be clear, because in the blue brief I thought I read that you said that the attorneys were present in Virginia at the Patent Office, and that's not the case. They were never physically there.
Present physically there, I don't believe the record says that. Present through correspondence, directly with the Patent Office, not via the WIPO, yes.
Judge Goyaz's question, I don't know whether it was this point it was behind this question, but it occurs to me, why do we have jurisdiction of this malpractice action?
I'm sorry.
Why does the Federal Circuit have jurisdiction of this appeal? Why shouldn't it have gone to the Fourth Circuit?
I'm in a bit of a tough spot here, Your Honor, because as you know, we were substituted in for the original counsel. I don't know what the thinking was in filing the Federal Circuit or not here.
But
thinking about it now, I'm here now. Thinking about it now, I guess it's because of the district court's decision that it does arise out of a patent case. Which was used for the remand motion.
Well, we're not considering here whether the source code should have been there. No. We're just considering the transaction of business, the Virginia long arm statute. Why do we have it? Do we properly have it? I know why we have it. You brought it here.
I would submit that you do properly have it because it was found to be arising out of the patent code, and because if you do find jurisdiction remanded back, we are going to have to satisfy the trial within trial
what
on
is,
the patent
what
case.
What is there in the patent code that we're dealing with?
Very good question. I hate to use a Sarah Palin, but I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Well, let me try to help you out. I mean, I know the district court did. You were before the district court in Virginia, right? I mean, it seems to me, at least in their opinion, they did analyze this question, and they relied on air measurement and that aching gum case.
For the purpose, that's why I said.
And
the
they said that if they have to determine, but for this, there would have been a patent. That there has to be an analysis of the patent that comes under patent law. I mean, rightly or wrongly, at least that's as much as the district court told us.
That's correct, and that's what I was saying. There's going to have to be a case within a case when we do go back to try the malpractice case. But His Honor, Judge Lurie asked me for a specific code in the patent code. I just don't have one. I apologize.
Well, you're here only because the lower court determined that it would arise under the patent laws under 1338. Right. There's no diversity jurisdiction. You're both Canadian citizens.
That is correct.
With respect to the issue of the actual tort that was undertaken, it was malpractice, if at all, hypothetically. Now, if in fact it's malpractice, then it's under state law that is determined. is that determined under federal law?
No, I believe that would be under state
law. So it would be under state law. So this is a state law cause of action.
It's a state law cause of action, but...
And why wouldn't the state court then be in a position of determining whether or not the misfiling of, the alleged misfiling of the source code was in error?
Well, we
and the patent, because of that, proved to be invalid.
We would have been happy to be in state court. We initially brought this action in state court. It's the court who refused to remand it.
I understand that. But at that point, then, the appeal should have been taken to the Fourth Circuit, as Judge Lurie pointed out, because it does not arise under 1338. If at all, it might arise under Rule 4K2.
Well, we did argue under Rule 4K2 in our briefs, and we believe that there is jurisdiction under Rule 4K2.
But that does not give us jurisdiction. That might be jurisdiction for the Fourth Circuit.
All I can go back and say is the district court did rule that there was patent issues here that was arising under a patent case. And if we were to go back to the state court, while the cause of action would be determined under the malpractice law of Virginia, for the causation side of the case, they will have to essentially conduct a case within the case. They'll have to conduct the patent trial and assess the other defenses that may have been available to the infringer.
Why would Virginia law apply? If the conflicts of laws in the state of Virginia say that the situs would be in Canada, wouldn't Canadian law apply? Wouldn't the local court be required to apply Canadian law?
I believe that the court would be required to apply U.S. laws because
Why?
We're dealing with a U.S. patent here. We're dealing with infringement of
a U.S. patent. No, you're dealing with malpractice.
Right, but...
You aren't dealing with infringement. You're dealing with malpractice.
But the damages for that malpractice are the damages that we would have recovered against the entity in the Texas case had there not been the malpractice. They raised certain other defenses. Those would have to be weighed.
Are you saying the malpractice claim necessarily involves a question of U.S. patent law?
Correct.
Under Christensen v. Colt...
And under the district court's decision.
Jurisdiction.
And under the district court's decision.
You want to save your rebuttal time?
Thank you.
Ms. Ashley. Do you belong here?
I hope so. May it please the court. The judgment of the district court in this case should be affirmed. Should be affirmed on one of two grounds. The district court was correct in its jurisdictional analysis. We also believe that the judgment under Rule 12B can be affirmed, even if he was wrong on that, on the grounds that this claim is barred by the Virginia statute of limitations. Our position is that the district court correctly decided this case on the jurisdictional claims that were pleaded and the jurisdictional arguments that were presented to him, and that's the proper basis upon which this court should review and on which this court should affirm his decision. The three paragraphs of the amended complaint that contain the jurisdictional allegations are paragraphs 6, 7, and 8. Paragraph 6 is a general jurisdiction allegation that was effectively abandoned before the district court and is not raised here. Paragraph 7 and paragraph 8 raise two of the four subsections.
But before we go through all that, Mr. Ashley, doesn't the U.S. have an interest in ensuring that foreign patent applications for patents secured here are adequately represented before the patent office? Isn't there a U.S. interest with regard to patent office litigation?
There's a U.S. interest. There is a U.S. interest, I believe, in the patent itself. But the interest really does not apply to this malpractice case, which is a malpractice case that we believe would be governed by Canadian law and is a dispute between two Canadian citizens over the application of law. In that malpractice case, there is a question of U.S. patent law that would have to be decided on that case. But as far as the U.S. interest is concerned in the patent itself, that interest was, I think, addressed and determined in the East Texas action, where the patent itself was held invalid. The issue in Canada is sort of like the issue in Asahi Metals. The issue in Canada is whether now Touchcom, who has lost its patent, can turn around and get indemnity from its Canadian patent firm for the damages that it sustained as a result of the loss of its patent.
But if that's true, I mean, the court referred to the fact that Virginia law and Canadian law on the malpractice question are very similar. But in that case, doesn't it make sense to adjudicate this case here, particularly in the Eastern District of Virginia, where there's a familiarity with patent law? Because we all recognize that at bottom, to adjudicate this case, there's going to have to be a patent law determination.
Well, I think the the question was raised before about whether there was jurisdiction in the Virginia court in the first place, and of course that's the air measurements and the Municep.
Well, not whether there's jurisdiction here or in the alternatively in the Fourth Circuit.
Well, right, but if this case were litigated in the United States, if there was jurisdiction over this claim in the United States, then I think the fact that there is a question of federal patent law involved in the state malpractice case makes it, under Municep and air measurement, makes it appropriate for the federal court to decide the case because the malpractice case turns on that question. But where you have two foreign citizens litigating a breach of contract legal malpractice action under Canadian law, then I don't think the same interest, U.S. interest, really holds. The situation there really, again, is like Asahi Metals, or like the situation in a case that, and I apologize to the court, that we didn't cite, but our opponents didn't either. They rely very heavily on the Lextex case, which is was noted earlier in the argument, is a case that was decided by the D.C. Court of Appeals on certification from the D.C. Circuit. And in that case, later, though, this court did address the same issues that were concerned in Lextex, and it's in the case of Zanibach, I think it is, versus Mylan Pharmaceuticals. That case is at 173 F. 3rd, 829. And it's an odd decision because there actually were two opinions for the court and then a dissent, but there was no opinion on the dissent. But it addresses the same issue as Lextex does, and it concludes that under the government contracts exception or under the construction, in that case, of Maryland's long-arm statute, that the filing in the patent office, or in that case, it was a filing of a new drug application, abbreviated new drug application, in the FDA office in Maryland. And the filing of that application by a generic drug manufacturer was itself a federal tort. So the English company that had the patent sued the Pennsylvania company in Pennsylvania for infringement. That was transferred to Maryland. It went back to Pennsylvania and then was ordered transferred back to Maryland but certified to this court. This court looked at that issue.
In other words, there was proper jurisdiction in the Maryland District Court because the FDA was there?
Well, that was the issue. That was the issue, whether the company who had been sued in Pennsylvania could be sued in Maryland. And the only thing that it had done in Maryland was to make the FDA filing.
Was the FDA a defendant?
No. It was sued by the English company. And again, there were two opinions that reached the result that it was unconstitutional for that to be a basis of exercise over the generic drug manufacturer. One opinion, as I read it, found that under the government contacts exception that is discussed in the Lextex case, that...
But Lextex didn't state, and of course it was, as you say, a D.C. Court of Appeals case, not a federal case, and certainly not binding on us, didn't establish a federal, an immunity from suit in the situs of the federal agency.
No, what Lextex said was because the agent who was making the filing had failed to disclose the prior art, that that was a tort, that was part of the tort, and therefore the government contacts document didn't apply.
What is the government contracts doctrine? In what case holds accordingly?
Well, the government contacts document doctrine that was applied in Lextex was originally in another D.C. Court of Appeals case called Environmental Research International. And in that case, you had an out-of-state company that hired a D.C. company to go and help them out before the EPA. They didn't pay, and the D.C. company sued. And the holding in that case was because the work they were doing was to interact with the government agency, that could not constitute doing business within the District of Columbia.
Okay, that's a D.C. Court of Appeals holding.
That's the D.C. Court of Appeals. Okay. The exception, then, that they made in Lextex was that where the agent had actually participated, had engaged in tortious conduct, then the government contacts exception didn't apply under those circumstances.
But he was not present in D.C., was he? In the Lextex?
In Lextex he was.
In Maryland?
Excuse me?
Was he personally present?
Yes. Yes, he was.
In D.C.?
And so,
in D.C. or Maryland?
All right, now let me go to the Maryland case, though. In Zanibot, he was personally present,
but we're talking about Lextex.
In D.C.
And that had to do with D.C.
Right.
Right, okay.
But the same thing, Maryland was exactly the same thing. And what they held in that case was the principal could not be subject to jurisdiction based upon the infringement, even though the principal actually committed an act of infringement in Maryland, and that was the cause of action that the English company was sued on. They held that under the government contacts exception, that didn't count as a jurisdictional contact for doing business, and therefore there was no basis for jurisdiction in Maryland.
Are you saying we should affirm here on the basis of a government contact exception?
No, you should affirm here on the basis that that the district court correctly found that the tort was committed in Canada. It was committed when they failed to. The allegation is they failed to include this the
in other
source
words,
code.
It was
so
a,
that was a
was
breach
the,
of duty.
The drafting and the rendering of services rather than the filing.
That is the under. Clear under Canadian law and as found by the district court and under Virginia law, it is that's the legal injury, is the preparing and then putting in the mail the defective application. That's when the cause of action arose. And so
I'm not clear on that. I mean, there's no effect of anything that was done in Canada in the absence of something ending up on the desk of someone at the patent office in Virginia, right? So it can't be entirely happening in Canada.
It doesn't entirely happen in Canada, but Virginia is very clear on this, and if you read it's the Shipman case that we cite in our brief, that the cause of action under Virginia law and the right of action, the legal injury, occurs in Canada, even though the damages may be caused by where that application travels and then the effects that result from the application.
Well, but the application was prosecuted in the state of Virginia before the patent office.
Well,
the failure to properly prosecute that application is a cause of action, isn't it?
No, sir.
What is it?
The cause of action is the breach of contract under it's either breach of contract or it is negligence in preparing a proper application.
No, it's negligence in preparing and filing an improper application. There would be no damage. Negligently preparing something that never gets filed is...
Well, but they prepared it and they filed it. If you go by that view, they prepared it and they filed it in England, in Great Britain. And then,
well, that's not a good argument at all. I mean, they file it before the Patent Office. They intended to file it before the Patent Office, period. And that prosecution was a failure in properly prosecuting the patent application.
Your Honor, under Virginia law, I think under the Shipman case, it's quite clear that the cause of action arose in Canada when they actually prepared and submit and they prepared that improper application. But even if that view is correct, then I go to the Zenibach case, because the under the government contacts view, which you cannot reconcile with...
Well, this is not a government contacts case. This is an actual prosecution of a patent application. So you're not pursuing a Lextex type of an argument. I don't think Lextex is applicable in that particular situation, is it? If you're looking for the government contacts exception?
The only jurisdictional contact that they allege that Bereskin and Parr had was with the Patent Office in Virginia, and it's the correspondence going to and from the Patent Office. And you know, we've said that that doesn't amount to transaction in Virginia sufficient based upon the Affinity Memory case. We've said even so, it doesn't, the cause of action doesn't arise from that under the Gallup Leasing case. But the third part, even if it does, then under, it was actually your opinion in the Zenibach case, under the, just like the filing with the FDA in Maryland, the filing of the defective application in the Patent Office in Virginia, it either doesn't count under Judge Rader's view of that because it has nothing to do with Virginia, or it doesn't count under the government contacts exception because of the way that this court interpreted it in Zenibach. And so for those reasons, we say that the district court's judgment should be affirmed. In addition, as we briefed, it's also clear under Virginia law that the statute of limitations would bar the claim even if there were personal jurisdiction.
Thank you, Mr. Ashley. Mr. Corpus.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to go through the Lextex Zeneca case one more time so it's clear. We did not cite Lextex for the proposition that the government contacts should or should not apply here. Lextex has language in it where the court said that it really cannot be disputed that there is jurisdiction by filing a patent application in D.C. and then went on to analyze whether or not the exception should apply. So we cited Lextex for that proposition, that the court find it simply beyond dispute that there would be jurisdiction, and I recognize that you, of course, are not bound by that decision, but it is instructive. Now, the Zeneca case is a completely different case. It's not a malpractice case. In our case, we retained the attorneys, Touchcom retained the attorneys to go and file a patent application, and that was the whole idea of the retainer, was to go and get us a U.S. patent in Virginia as well as patents elsewhere. Zeneca, all that happened in Maryland is that, and I only just saw it because it wasn't in the brief, I was handed it 5 minutes before the argument, but in the Zeneca case, all that happened is that Zeneca, the generic company, went and filed an FDA filing, which the court recognized was a purely artificial structure. It was not a very difficult process. It's not like going and filing a patent application, which is what the whole retainer was about in our case. And it's for that reason that the court found there was no jurisdiction in Zeneca.
You're saying filing an abbreviated new drug application is not comparable to filing a patent application?
Yes, Your Honor.
both applications before a federal agency containing a lot of material.
I'm saying something a little different, actually. I'm saying that filing an ANDA and whether jurisdiction exists over the filing is not equivalent to the question of whether jurisdiction exists over an attorney who contracted to file for a patent in Virginia. The contract is between us and the attorney here. In the other case, it's a direct suit against the party. Mr. Ashley referred to the Shipman case and whether or not injury occurred before the patent office, or in Virginia where the injury occurred in Canada. Of course, that's just one of the four grounds under the Virginia long-arm statute requiring that the injury took place in Virginia. The main one we believe that applies is the transacting business provision. There were transacting business in before the U.S. patent.
What interest does the state of Virginia have in assuring that a patent application is properly prosecuted before the patent office?
It has number one, it's because the patent office is located in Virginia.
No, I mean, what interest does the state of Virginia have? Does it have any interest in making sure that the patent application is properly prosecuted?
Well, it has an interest to the extent that there might be an infringing party in Virginia, a point over which we wanted to take discovery but were not given. It may have other interests, but the real interest is the U.S. interest.
Yeah, so there's no greater interest for a citizen of Virginia than there is of a citizen of Maryland?
Well, there is the same interest, I would say, depending on where the infringing party would be.
But there's no infringement here.
Well,
eventually there might be an interest in the state of Virginia, but right now there's no interest at all.
Well, there might.
Because you're prosecuted under federal laws, you're prosecuting it, all of the prosecutors are required to meet certain minimum standards that are set by the Patent Office, which is a federal agency. The state of Virginia has really minimal interest, if any, in the prosecution of a patent before the Patent Office.
Yes, but the long-arm statute, which has the four categories in it, we submit that the actions taken by the appellees fit into each one of those categories. Transacted business in Virginia, contracted to supply goods and services in Virginia.
This is the long-arm statute of the state intended to protect its citizens from someone out of state reaching in to do business with, say, a resident of the state, and the state has an interest in protecting its own citizens. Here it's quite different. The plaintiff and the defendant are Canadians. The only activity in Virginia, if any, is in the federal agency, which is not a defendant or a plaintiff.
Well, that is true to an extent, but the long-arm statute is also there to determine whether there were sufficient contacts, if it appeared in person before the PTO, for example, and if there was other activity taken in Virginia, even though the only contact was the U.S. Patent Office, there would still be jurisdiction.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Corpus. We'll take the case under advisement.